Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Death of Death, where we proclaim Christ's victory over sin, death, and everything else. I'm your host, as always, Nick Stewart. I'm glad to be here with you today. I have a really cool topic for today and something I'm surprised we haven't really gotten to yet. We're talking a little bit about covenant theology today, but specifically I want to address the nature of Abraham's covenants and how it relates to baptism, which is a pretty big topic, so I hope I can do it justice. I also want to address some of Jesus's comments to the Pharisees in John 8. So, you know, it's just something I've passed through in my Bible recently and was inspired to talk about it here. The only piece of business I have for today is to announce that there is finally going to be some Death of Death merch coming. I'm waiting on a shipment of stickers with the podcast logo on them and also an order of t-shirts with the same logo. And I'm pretty stoked about it because I've been wanting to do this pretty much since the beginning. I'm setting up an online store where you're going to be able to buy this stuff when it's available. Also, all of our Patreon supporters are going to get a free t-shirt and sticker. Unfortunately, that's just for our current elect members as of right now, but if you sign up before November 1st, you can get a very significant discount on that stuff. And then after November 1st, patrons are still going to get a discount. It's just not going to be as good. So go over to patreon.com/deathofdeath and sign up for just $4 a month. And when you get onto Patreon, just send me a message on there about the merch. And when it's available, I'll be in contact with you on how to purchase it. So I'm really stoked about that. Really stoked that there's finally going to be some t-shirts out there, stickers. Just give the stickers to a bunch of kids and just tell them to go around town and just put them all over the place. Set them loose on the Irvine Spectrum. I'm pretty sure that place is closed down now, so no one will be able to stop them. All right, that's the business I've got for today, so let's start talking about covenant theology. I've been making my way through the Bible this year, doing the chronological reading plan from ESV, and I've only found some minimal errors with it. I recently passed John 8. That's the chapter where Jesus rebukes the Pharisees and tells them they're sons of Satan, which, by the way, we need to bring that back. Like, there's a thing going on now. If you've been anywhere near the internet as a Christian lately, you're probably aware of everything blowing up with quote-unquote woke Christianity lately. I haven't really dived in yet to see exactly what's being said and all the back and forth, but it seems like a lot of people are starting to talk about it. Jeff Durbin fired some shots, it looks like. That was the first thing that I saw, and I don't even mean that in a negative way, but that was just the first thing I remember seeing with this whole wave of controversy I see exploding, and it looks like a few others started to follow his example. To his credit, he's actually been calling out woke Christianity for a long time, but it's just starting to get a lot of attention online for some reason. Anyways, my whole point in bringing that up is that we should bring back that offspring of the devil talk. You know, we should start dropping a little "you serve your father the devil" again, because I think that's an effective an effective insult. I'm gonna do an episode on critical race theory soon, because Patreon supporter and artwork collaborator Cameron Morgan has been asking me to do one for a while, so more on that to come. But it's one of the many episodes that I've been planning to do for a while, but it's a big undertaking, so I'm not sure when I'm really going to have time to do it justice, which I want to make sure I don't, you know, waste an episode on such a big topic without actually getting it right. So I guess in a roundabout way, that relates to what I'm talking about today, because my original point was the awesome and savage way that Jesus puts the Pharisees in their place in John 8. But just to catch you up to speed on where I'm coming from in this whole thing, a lot of you may not know. I spent a small amount of time as a paedobaptist. Paedobaptism is the belief that the children of Christians should be baptized as infants because they are members of the covenant of grace by birthright. typically, and I think you all know by now that I'm not a paedo-baptist anymore, but typically when someone is exposed to Reformed theology, it takes a while to become like legitimately Reformed. So I'm not trying to sound elitist, but the accepted definition of Reformed and the one that I would hold to, which you know if you've heard the episodes I've done on confessionalism, is basically subscribing to a Reformed confession of faith. Rarely, if ever, does someone jump straight to that. So, like, the London Baptist Confession, I subscribe to that. I take, you know, very few exceptions, but the large strokes of that whole confession, I agree with. And so, Reformed theology is a system. It's a system of all theology. Like, there is a Reformed position on every part of theology, so it's not just, you know, Calvinism, which is the, you know, the 5 points, the doctrines of grace or whatever you want to call them. But that's usually what happens. What usually happens is, and, you know, my story is similar to most Reformed people, is that you're exposed to the 5 points of Calvinism first. And, you know, real quick, if you don't know, I'm sure there's very few people listening to this podcast if you don't already know it, but 5 points of Calvinism are: total depravity, the doctrine that man is evil and incapable of seeking and turning to God; unconditional election, the doctrine that God chooses to save some people, not on the basis of anything they've done or not done, but because of his grace. And that's what Romans 9 through 11, that's what Romans 9:11 says about Jacob being chosen and Esau not being chosen. They were, you know, both pretty bad guys, but regardless, God chose Jacob because of his grace. And then there's limited atonement, which I prefer to call definite atonement, the doctrine that Jesus died to pay for the sins of the elect and not anyone else. Jesus did not pay for the sins of anybody who will spend eternity in hell. Otherwise, he didn't really pay for their sins. And the reason I prefer to call it definite atonement is because it definitely atones for the people it's meant for. It's not limited, you know, really. It's limited to the believers, but it's not limited in the scope of its efficacy. So I prefer to call it definite atonement. There's irresistible grace. That's point number 4, the doctrine that a member of the elect will not be able to resist God's grace in saving them. This is in direct correlation to the previous 2 points, because obviously once God chooses you and Jesus pays for your sins by his blood, you're not going to be able to reject that. It's irresistible. Paul the Apostle lays those 3 points out pretty clearly in Ephesians 1. I'm pretty sure it's verses 4, 7, and 13, when he says that the Father chose us, the Son redeemed us, and the Spirit seals us. So election is actually a Trinitarian doctrine at its root. The word seal that Paul uses there in Ephesians 1 is actually the same word they used for the seal that they would put on shipments going overseas. So the person sending that package or, you know, whatever it was, would, you know, the crate or whatever, would put their seal on it, and that would determine the destination it would go to. And so when the Spirit seals us, God is determining our destination. Like predestination, right? And then the last of the 5 points is the perseverance of the saints, the doctrine that once someone is saved, they cannot lose their salvation. Obviously, how could you specifically be chosen by the Father and redeemed by the Son and then sealed by the Spirit, and you're still capable of rejecting that and damning yourself? So that was more exposition on the 5 points than I was expecting to do, but in case someone really is hearing all this for the first time, it's helpful to know what I'm talking about. So this is usually a person's first exposure to any kind of Reformed theology. I actually remember the night that I heard all this for the first time. My friend Mario DiBella took me to A's Burgers in Dana Point and explained the 5 points to me. And I've never really had a night like that before or since. Like, I actually thought I was going to cry. And I am not a crier. Anyone who knows me knows that. I was just overcome with the beauty of God choosing me, even though I did absolutely nothing to deserve it. In fact, everything I did made me not deserve it. I don't think theology has ever affected me quite the way that it did that night, you know? And that's what made me get into theology. That's what made me want to learn more and study more. So I guess I really have Mario De Bella to thank for my obsession with theology, and you all have Mario to thank for this podcast, I guess, in an indirect way. So most people start with Reformed theology by becoming Calvinists, just meaning that they hold to the 5 points of Calvinism. And yes, I know that John Calvin himself didn't actually chart out these 5 points, the official 5 points, if you want a little history. The official 5 points were formed in 1618 after John Calvin's death as a response to the followers of Jacob Arminius, the Arminians. That's the opposite of Calvinism you'll hear thrown around. Their 5 points, which were the first 5 points, are just the opposite of the 5 points that the Calvinists proffered in response. So, you know, man's not incapable of choosing God. God chooses people based on his foreknowledge of their belief, and Jesus bore the sins of everyone, and people can resist the grace of God, and a person can ultimately fall away from the faith permanently and in a way that can result in their eternal damnation, and they can make that choice. So Calvinists are, you know, not necessarily people who know everything about John Calvin's writings any more so than Arminians know everything about Jacob Arminius's writings. It's just shorthand for these beliefs on how people are saved. And that's the study of salvation, and that's known as soteriology. So the 5 points of Calvinism are just the soteriology of Reformed theology, and that's just a small piece of the whole system of belief. So most people start out by becoming Calvinists, just believers in the 5 points of Calvinism, and, you know, otherwise known as like the canons of Dort or the doctrines of grace. You know, there's a lot of baggage with the word Calvinism, so sometimes it's helpful to call it something else. And now they think they're Reformed, but it's not, you know, quite that simple. Reformed theology is a large system of belief and biblical interpretation. So in my experience, I was starting to notice that lots of people in the Reformed faith held certain positions on things other than just soteriology, other than, you know, just how we get saved. They had similar, you know, beliefs on other topics as well. I think the next thing I noticed was eschatology. Like, why do so many of these Reformed people seem to have a different eschatology than me? You know, like, they don't talk about the rapture or the Antichrist or any of that stuff. And I had actually never been taught anything besides dispensationalism, so I didn't even know there were other options. But these are all topics we can go into depth on in other episodes. But my point in bringing it up is that eschatology is usually the backdoor to covenant theology, which is the broader system of all Reformed theology, and it's basically the, you know, Reformed interpretation of the Bible. So I hope I can do this subject enough justice to at least get you started if you don't know anything about it yet. But a huge part of dispensationalism, which is not a Reformed belief system, is the idea that there are promises yet to be fulfilled for the nation of Israel. And in dispensationalism, they believe that the Christians are removed in the rapture sometime in the future. And you all probably know something about that, just even through pop culture. And once the Christians are all gone, the remaining promises to Israel are fulfilled. And after that, Jesus reigns on the earth, and the devil is bound for 1,000 years, and then he's released. And there's yet another showdown where the devil is finally defeated, and then the new heavens and new earth come about. Now, that's a very broad sweep, and I'm leaving a lot of things out, but the first counterposition I became aware of was amillennialism. And, you know, amillennialists don't believe in a literal 1,000-year reign of Christ on the earth. They believe that the entire time in between the first and second coming is the millennial kingdom, the 1,000-year reign of Christ on the earth. And in this case, 1,000 years just represents a long time. But, you know, here's the problem. Without some form of covenant theology, you won't know what to think about the promises to Israel. And it does seem that some promises were never fulfilled. So, you know, what's the deal with that? But I just typically started recognizing sometime after I became a Calvinist, thinking I was Reformed, that a lot of Reformed people were also amillennialists. And then, you know, I kind of wondered, like, okay, what's the connection with all that? And, like, why are they all, you know, cessationists? Like, they don't speak in tongues and stuff. And so what basically you find out at some point in your journey with Reformed theology is that covenant theology is the main linchpin of all Reformed theology, and it's basically where all the other smaller doctrines come from in that system. So in covenant theology, basically it teaches that the entire Bible is structured by covenants, and I'm not going to address all the covenants because this is not really specifically like a general sweep of, you know, covenant theology. This is kind of just about baptism, but God makes a covenant with Abraham and then with Israel and then later with David. So, like, how do these covenants connect to each other? Like, do they connect to each other even? That's what covenant theology studies and deals with. So that's definitely a topic we're going to have to get into on another episode, just, you know, covenant theology in general. But for the purposes of our discussion right now, when it comes to the covenant with Israel, and specifically with the promises related to the land, I'll just say Joshua records that all of the promises relating to the land are fulfilled when they first enter the promised land in Joshua. God specifically says it in Joshua 21. So almost immediately they screw it up and fall into idolatry, and the covenant is broken. So from that time on, God has absolutely no obligation to Israel when it comes to the land, but they remain in the land nonetheless. So they're even exiled at one point, and God brings them back. So why? Like, why would God go through the trouble of reinstating them to the land if that promise had been revoked? And it's simple, because of the Messiah. The oldest covenant promise of God was that the seed of Eve would crush the head of the serpent, and that's Jesus. And this promise is built upon throughout the entire Old Testament. So everything God does for the people of Israel when it comes to the land is to fulfill his promises of a Messiah. Then Jesus is actually born, and that purpose is fulfilled. And Jesus actually is Israel, and he is everything an Israelite was supposed to be. He was perfectly obedient to God's covenant, and even a reference to Hosea 11 in the Gospel of Matthew actually tells us specifically that Jesus is fulfilling prophecies about Israel as if he himself were Israel. So all of the promises to Israel are fulfilled in Jesus, and now we, the church, are in union with Christ. You know, the church is not Israel, but we are partakers in Jesus, and Jesus is Israel. So, you know, we are included in that. It's just not that we're included specifically in the nation, we're included in Christ. Read Romans 9 through 11 if you want to know more about that. There's an analogy of a tree and natural branches, which are the Jews. They're cut off, and then the natural branches and the wild branches are grafted back onto the tree, and the wild branches are the Gentiles, like people who aren't Jewish. So it's saying Jews and Gentiles alike can be in union with Jesus. And, you know, dispensationalists generally misinterpret this to mean that Israel is the tree and Gentiles can be included in it along with the Jews, but Jesus is actually the tree and both Jews and Gentiles can be included. So if you really want to get into this topic, what I've said here is not really going to be enough to understand it fully, but I'm just trying to give you the big picture. So I'll have some resources in the show notes if you want to know more. But now we're finally getting to covenant theology. We as the church are in the new covenant with Christ. We are members of the covenant of grace. Adam's covenant with God in the garden was a covenant of works, which was broken when Adam and Eve sinned and mankind fell. So when God promises the seed of the woman will crush the head of the serpent, that's Jesus he's talking about. So as soon as the covenant of works is broken, the covenant of grace is promised. So everything from that point is a step along the way to the covenant of grace. So here's the main difference between Reformed Baptists and the rest of Reformed theology. Paedobaptists, if you remember, are the ones who baptize their children. So They believe that the covenant of grace officially begins in the Old Testament, and everything before Christ is a different version of it. So we use the word administration to say that. So you'll hear the phrase one covenant with two administrations. And that's an intimidating phrase at first, but they're just saying, you know, basically that the covenant with Abraham, for example, is just a different version of the covenant we're currently in with Christ. But what the Reformed Baptists believe is that the old covenant, that would be everything between the promise of Eve's seed crushing the serpent all the way up until Jesus ratifies the new covenant at the Last Supper, that's the old covenant. And the old covenant is not the same as the new covenant. The old covenant is a promise form of the new covenant. So helpfully, the London Baptist Confession says it this way in chapter 7. I think it's paragraph 3. This covenant is revealed, first of all, to Adam in the promise of salvation by the seed of the woman, and afterwards by farther steps until the full discovery thereof was completed in the New Testament. So that's the key right there, by farther steps. So it's not just a different version of the new covenant in the old covenant. It's like a staircase leading to the new covenant. The old covenant has elements of grace in it, obviously, like even in the sacrificial system of the old covenant, you know, the very existence of animal sacrifices to cover the people's sins implies an amount of grace from God. You know, God didn't expect them not to sin. He gave them a way to atone for it, you know. However, like Hebrews tells us, it wasn't perfect because you would always have to sacrifice another animal and another and another. Jesus makes one sacrifice and he sits down at the right hand of the Father. His work is done. It's a perfect sacrifice. So it's not as cut and dry as to say the old covenant isn't a covenant of grace, because there is a large amount of grace in it. It's just not totally fulfilled yet. It's a promise of the covenant of grace. So now how does this relate to baptism? Like, I hope I haven't lost you yet. You know, I'm trying to explain it as best I can without taking 4 hours, but if you do have any questions, you can email contact@deathofdeath.net, and I'll address it on another episode, and, you know, so get your questions out if you don't understand any of this. Here's how it all ties to baptism. In Old Testament Israel, they had signs for their covenants. So one of the signs was circumcision. Males were circumcised on the eighth day. That was a sign that they were covenant members, that they were in a covenant with God. Every Israelite was a covenant member because the covenant was with the entire nation of Israel. So paedobaptists believe something similar about the new covenant. They believe that believers and their children are all members of the new covenant. In Israel, every Israelite was technically a covenant member, and some were actually faithful and regenerate. And men like Abraham and David were actually regenerate, but everyone else in Israel, even, you know, the unbelievers, were covenant members, you know? So similarly in the church, you've got true believers and their children, and some of their children may grow up not to be believers, but they go to church, they're treated like believers, some of them may even take communion when they get a little older, so they are the visible church. They are, so far as we can see, covenant members. The invisible church is only made up of true believers, but everybody in the church is technically part of the visible church. So that's a concept we're going to get to soon, but it's the difference between inward and outward. You know, it's every member of a church are outwardly covenant members, but only the ones that are inwardly regenerate and true believers are true covenant members. So that brings us to what Paul says in Colossians 2. Colossians 2:11-12. In him also you were circumcised with a circumcision made without hands, by putting off the body of the flesh by the circumcision of Christ, having been buried with him in baptism, in which you were also raised with him through faith in the powerful working of God who raised him from the dead. So in him you were circumcised, having been buried with him in baptism. This is not the only verse the paedobaptist will use, but I think this is the most obvious choice for drawing a connection between baptism and circumcision. So, if baptism in the new covenant is equivalent to circumcision in the old covenant, what would that mean? Well, the paedobaptist believes that it would be applied to new covenant children. So they baptized their children the same way that all the Israelite children were circumcised. Well, the boys were, anyways. And some will grow into legitimate covenant members and some will not. So just like in Israel. So some Israelites were like Abraham and some were like Ahab. You know, some believed, some not. Some were like Solomon and some were like Absalom, you know? This is essentially what they mean when they say one covenant with two administrations. They mean that the people of Israel in the old covenant were under the same exact covenant that we are as Christians, but they were in, like, they were under a different application of it. So they'll say a different administration. So in that administration, they circumcise male infants. In this administration, we baptize babies. But they believe it's the same covenant. So we're going to get to that in a minute. But I'm not denying that some kids are in the church from birth and they're taught well and raised in the Lord and they grow up to be legitimate Christians and they can't remember a time when they weren't saved or didn't believe because they were always in the church and always exposed to it. I'm not denying that, but I do not believe that children of believers are automatically covenant members. I hope to circle back at the end and explain at least one or two examples in the New Testament, how it's pretty clear that only believers are covenant members. But believe it or not, it includes some of the same verses that the paedobaptists use to justify baptizing their infants. So this finally brings us to Abraham and the nature of his covenants with God. And yes, that's right. Covenants, plural. Paedobaptists generally believe that God made one covenant with Abraham, and that includes circumcision, but it's not quite that neat and tidy, as you probably figured. God makes his first covenant with Abraham in Genesis 15, where he promises to give his people a land, and his people will be more numerous than the stars. That's where they cut the animals in half and make the covenant. And God put Abraham to sleep and ratifies that covenant by himself. You know the story. There's actually a lot in that story that we should talk about at some point, but not today. It's not until Genesis 17 that God makes the covenant with Abraham that includes circumcision. So these are two separate covenants that God made with Abraham, but it's understandable if you don't really see the difference, because the first covenant was a covenant of faith. Remember, it says that Abraham believed and God counted it to him as righteousness. The second covenant in Genesis 17 is where God tells Abraham that kings will come from you. This is a covenant for the members of Abraham's flesh. So one is an internal covenant, or an invisible covenant, if you will. It's of the heart. It's faith. The other is an external covenant, visible. It's of the flesh. So the reason it's hard to see the difference sometimes is because both of these covenants are centered on Christ. The inward covenant, the one of faith and of the heart, is essentially a belief in the promise of the gospel. Remember, Jesus said, "Abraham saw my day and rejoiced," a belief in the gospel before they had the full picture. On the other hand, the external covenant, the covenant of the flesh, is to preserve the lineage of the Messiah. So they're both centered on Jesus. It's just, one is a faith in the coming Messiah, and one is the lineage of that Messiah. So they're dependent on each other. Like, you can't have one without the other. That's why they're so inseparable in our interpretation. And they kind of like spiral together, you know, kind of intersecting at different points. Like, they depend on each other to achieve both things. So it's not quite as simple as one covenant with two administrations, like we talked about a minute ago, like how they believe it's essentially the same covenant in both Old Testament and New. We just have different signs and traditions to express it. So it would be unfair to say that the Paedobaptists don't believe this at all. They just apply it a lot differently. So the Old Covenant is not a different administration of the New Covenant. The New Covenant is just that. It's a new covenant. So I know I'm kind of getting into the weeds here, but this is the whole point. The covenant of Abraham's flesh is only for the purpose of the Messiah being born. Once Jesus is born, that covenant is fulfilled. The covenant of Abraham's faith, the internal heart covenant, is the promise of the new covenant. It's not a different administration of the new covenant. It's a promise. It's a foreshadowing of the new covenant. It's a staircase leading to the new covenant. So once the new covenant comes, the promises relating to flesh are fulfilled. The land, circumcision, you know, those have been fulfilled with the coming of Jesus. But I believe because God made two covenants with Abraham, and because of the nature of those two covenants, that Jesus is able to say things like this in John 8. Listen to John 8:37. I know that you are offspring of Abraham. Verse 39, Jesus said to them, if you were Abraham's children, you would be doing the works that Abraham did. Verse 44, you are of your father the devil, and your will is to do your father's desires. Verse 56, your father Abraham rejoiced that he would see my day. So look at everything Jesus said about the Pharisees' relation to Abraham. I know that you are the offspring of Abraham, but if you were Abraham's children, you are of your father the devil. And finally, your father Abraham. So what's the deal? Like, are they Abraham's offspring or not? How is he able to say all those things without contradicting himself? Well, it's because of Abraham's two covenants. They are, according to the flesh, related to Abraham. They are his offspring, but not according to the faith. If it was one covenant, they would either be in it or not. We know the old covenant didn't just require one to be an Israelite, okay? Like, I'll grant you that. It required someone to be an Israelite and obey the covenant. But nonetheless, there were benefits from the covenant that would benefit not just faithful members, but also anyone who lived in Israel. Even if they didn't obey the covenant, they would benefit from that covenant. So that's because Abraham had two covenants, one of faith and one of flesh. The Pharisees were the offspring of Abraham when it came to the flesh, and they had no relation to Abraham when it came to the faith. They would not automatically be included in the new covenant just because of their relation to Abraham. I can't tell you how many times I've read John 8 and never noticed how Jesus both affirms and denies their relation to Abraham all in the same chapter. Now we can see how that's possible because of covenant theology. So I'm going to wrap this up with just returning to Colossians 2 really quick. I'll read it again, 2:11-12. In him also you were circumcised with a circumcision made without hands, by putting off the body of the flesh by the circumcision of Christ. Having been buried with him in baptism, in which you were also raised with him through faith in the powerful working of God who raised him from the dead. So the circumcision that's being equated to baptism is not a physical circumcision like they practiced in Israel. It's a circumcision made without hands. It's the circumcision of Christ. This is the cutting away of the flesh when the Spirit regenerates our hearts, when God changes our heart of stone into a heart of flesh. Circumcision was a symbol of a spiritual reality, that the sinful flesh would be cut away as a sign of our covenant with God. Now that's an internal reality, and as a result of that, we are baptized, symbolizing Jesus' death, burial, and resurrection. It's clear that the circumcision without hands comes, and then we are baptized. And that's just one example of a verse that's pretty classically used for paedobaptism, but it actually argues for credo baptism a lot better. We've been going for a while now, so I'm going to cut it off there, but no pun intended. I'd like to do another episode where we can go through, you know, a lot of the scriptures that paedobaptists use and show how they actually teach credo baptism. I hope that you got something out of this episode. This is a very big topic, so we're probably going to cover it, you know, in future, near future episodes. And it's not easy to understand at first, you know, so I'm going to link to some resources in the show notes. So if you want to get into covenant theology, or maybe you're already into it and you want to go a little further with like Baptist covenant theology, whatever, pick your poison. Guess all that's left is just share this episode if you got something out of it, and go sign up on Patreon so you can get a discount on that merchandise when it's available. I think that's it. So I've been your host, Nick, here to tell you not to sprinkle your babies. And if you're as committed to Christ's victory as I am, I'll be here to do it with you all again next week. Goodbye for now.